From the southernmost point of Dorne to the lands of always winter, what is west of west and Westeros and the shadows in the east. This is Casterly Talk. I'm Catnapsock for another episode that is a Game of Thrones rewatch. It's the 98th episode overall of Casterly Talk, the 21st of our rewatch, because we are up to Season 3, Episode 1, Valor, not Morghulis, Valor Dorhaeris, because all men must serve, all men must die. That was the end of last season. Now we're into Season 3. Just me again today. Can't wait to get to having some pundits back on and eventually in studio, even all those kind of fun things. Part of the reason we're going to be able to do that is Casterly Talk is now a co-production with Morning Drive Media and the Good People Association, and is part of the GPA network. We got our own YouTube channel here. If you haven't subscribed, hit that subscribe button, bells, whistles, and shame, all those things. But a lot of you probably listen, in fact, more of you right now, definitely listen on the podcast feed, which is still the same spot. Now easier to rediscover on the Anchor app if you want to call and leave a message, which is something I certainly hope you all do. We got a great call today. We got some calls queued up for future episodes. That's what we're doing. Because my recording schedule, speaking honestly, is a little crazy, a little out of whack. It's a little all over the place. I can't really pinpoint when I'm recording episodes. So just if you have a call, you want to, something about Season 3, an episode far in advance, just call. Leave a message via the Casterly Talk app on the Anchor app, and I'll get to it. I'll get to it. I swear. I promise. Your calls really help fuel the show, as it did back in the day on Daily Thrones. The episode we're reviewing today is, like I said, Season 3, Episode 1, the 21st episode overall of the show here. And we are now into Season 3. The original air date of this, March 31st. 2013, coming back to that date in a second here, director Daniel Minahan, I should say, a staple of kind of the early seasons of Game of Thrones, even though his name is not tossed around as one of the great Game of Thrones directors, I think he really helped establish the tone of the show and everything going forward. Writers Benioff and Weiss, cinematographer Jonathan Freeman, editor Francis Parker. Should be noted this episode was dedicated to Martin Kenzie, cinematographer, cameraman, camera specialist who passed away from cancer during Season 3, the production of Season 3. He'd worked on previous seasons as a cinematographer, as I said, and, interesting note, was a second unit cameraman and camera operator on Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back. A little movie you might have heard it. He was on those teams as well. So that is sad news, but also, what a career. And this episode was dedicated to Martin Kenzie. As I said, we're getting into Season 3, which means we probably have some thoughts on Season 3. And I wanted to hear some of those thoughts from you. And we got Eric Monroe calling in with his thoughts of Season 3 going into our rewatch here.
Hey, Ken and Casterly Talk. So as we get ready to talk about Season 3 for the rewatch, I wanted to talk about my complicated relationship with Season 3, because for the longest time, it wasn't one of my favorite seasons. If you were to ask me after Season 4, what was your least favorite season, I would say, without question, Season 3. Now, I by no means mean that I didn't like it or I hated it. It just wasn't one of my favorite seasons. However, during my last rewatch of Game of Thrones, I just grew this whole new appreciation for the season. People can change, and I love the season now. Kiss by Fire is one of the best episodes of the series, and without question, it is Jaime Lannister's season. The arc he goes through during the season is absolutely incredible, so I can't wait to hear you talk about it and your thoughts. And we get some pretty good Stannis stuff.
We do get some good Stannis stuff. Oh boy, Eric and I, our love of Stannis is real. I'm with Eric on this. I'm so curious of my own thoughts on Season 3 at the end of this rewatch. And when I, at the end of really looking into Season 3. Season 3, I think, is remembered most for the Red Wedding. By the way, if you're watching the show for the first time, the show being Game of Thrones, and you're following along with me, apologies. This is looking back on the big themes and lessons of the show. So we're going to be talking as if you've watched it all. So binge or rewatch, get through and come back and join us here. I don't mean to get to some of the big spoilers, but it is just what it is. We're having a historical conversation looking back. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this. I keep kind of resetting the show and the themes of this show, Casterly Talk, hoping that a lot of new people are discovering it here, especially as we go into the GPA anchor. I'm not just here looking back on the moments and the things I loved and, you know, the characters. That's part of it. But I really want to look at this show because I believe the themes and lessons are universal. It is its own kind of modern myth, not unlike Star Wars, which is something big to my world and to my broadcasting career. And just looking at the show through that lens, but also now that all eight seasons are done and a little time has passed between that eighth and final season, just now going back and looking at these episodes and these seasons and seeing where it all kind of lays now. And I'm not one for ranking. It's fun, but I think that can be confused as criticism sometimes. But that said, I have in the past said that I'm not a huge fan of season three. By that, I mean, I love each and every one of the Game of Thrones seasons a lot. That's why I'm doing it. But I think season three, looking back, it's remembered for the Red Wedding, remembered for Daenerys getting the Unsullied and that big kind of Dracarys moment. I think some of the other stuff is maybe I'll say the word overrated, but it's a word I don't even want to throw out here, but I guess I will. I guess I just did. I really loved this season when it was happening. I really did. I just remember looking back, revisiting it while the show's going on and going, I just don't love everything in the season. I think that's going to change. Now, again, I don't like ranking seasons. I don't think there's, other than having fun, I just don't think there's much point to it. But, yeah, season seven has faltered for me over the course of time. Looking back, going, yeah, maybe that. Season three, I have some of those moments. And not even the moments of, that didn't work, or I didn't like that. But just, it didn't hit for me as much. It's kind of, I don't want to say a forgotten season in my own Game of Thrones watching career, if that's a thing. But other than those big moments, I sometimes struggle to remember what happened in season three. I can't remember that. The Jaime. Okay. Eric's right. It's a big Jaime Lannister season. A lot. This is the big stuff for him that bridges the gap. It's the midpoint, so to speak, of his own journey. I think a lot of things going on, a lot of big things left to come in Jaime with Jaime. I think Jaime lingers a little bit in season five and six. And I like where Jaime ends up overall. I really do. Tragic as it is, bittersweet as it is, and frustrating as it is. But we'll get to that. We have a lot of big Jaime stuff this season. So that's where I'm at, Eric. Curious myself as to what this rewatch is. And I just completed a rewatch. My girlfriend and I, Grace, watched the show, and I was doing it for Casterly Talk. Then I got ahead of my own podcast. And we watched it. We binged it. We went through fast, and I wasn't stopping, wasn't taking notes, wasn't looking at it. So I already kind of have a thought that, there's more things in season three than even I give it credit for. But I'm really excited to dive into everything going on. Now, I'll say this, the beginning of season three is one of my favorites. I mentioned that date, March 31st, 2013. I remember right where I was. This was the season now. Season one, popular. The numbers were growing. HBO figured they had a hit on their hand, but could they maintain it? Did they want to commit to it? It seemed to be, we'll give you a second season. We'll announce that a little bit later on, and they would get it. Second season, bigger numbers, big battle. That big Ned Stark beheading moment, maybe it wasn't in season two. There's some big deaths and some big moments, some water cooler moments indeed, but it's a more thoughtful season. It's perhaps a deeper season. There's a season then. Over time, I think people's view of season two has changed for the better. So now comes season three. By now, it's a thing. It's 2013. That geek culture, that nerd culture, that fandom culture, the podcast industry, the podcast punditry industry, good or bad or worse, it's alive and well. Game of Thrones season one, 2011. Oh, were there shows? Yeah. Were there podcasts? Yes. Yes, absolutely. But between then and season three, things have begun to change. The cast, every time they show up at Comic-Con, rock stars beyond belief. In fact, 2013 was my first Comic-Con. I can tell you, I was fortunate enough to be at a party with Kit Harington and Rose Leslie and Richard Madden and another one with George R. R. Martin. And I can tell you, he walked into the room and I was in the room staring at the elevator when the doors opened and George R. R. Martin appeared. Unbelievable. It was as if Elvis came back from the dead with the help of a fire god and walked into the room. The show was something special now. So this was that first season that I had a Game of Thrones viewing party. And the pilot episode, the first episode of the season, all my friends would gather around in my living room, and we just couldn't wait. A lot of the people in the room, longtime book readers, myself, I was finished with the first two books and had Storm of Swords and was like, should I read this before the season? No, I'm going to hold off. And I'm glad I did, because this is the last season for me that I experienced with everything being a full surprise. By season four, I had finished all the books and went ahead and got that the first five, and knew what was coming. It was a different experience, a fun experience, a full experience, but a different one than season three, where I just had no idea. So, in fact, there's some things that I remember thinking was going to happen in season two that, didn't come close to happening. So I remember, and I remember this cold opening. Oh my God, because season two ends with one of my favorite endings of any season. The army of the dead has approached the Fist of the First Men, and this one begins. So I'm not even worried about themes or lessons in this moment. This was just a cool moment. We were all freaked out. We were all scared. A cold open, something different. And Jorah Mormont's lines, we're going to talk about those in a bit, just absolutely sent chills down our spines, our collective spines, and we are ready for season three. And then the intro, the graphic, the movies, Ramajwadi's music plays. Yeah, we go around the map, and Winterfell was a smoking ruin. And we all cheered, not celebrating that Winterfell was a smoking ruin, but we just cheered that the graphics had changed and something new, and it was an ominous season too. Which might be some of season three, a little darker season, but then again, find me a bright, sunny, cheery season of Game of Thrones. Let's get into what we got going on here in season three, episode one, Valor Dohaeris. Taking a sip of my water out of my Star Wars Cantina mug. That's, you know, we're crossing the streams here. This episode, as we know, as we say, is All Men Must Serve, which follows season two's All Men Must Die ending. So the question is, what are they serving? Who are they serving? How? What? The whys? Who is serving? We need to know. Oddly enough, Arya Stark, the one who will go on to really learn this phrase and learn it well, not present in this one. And overall, I will say about this episode, this was the first time I started to hear, as now, again, Game of Thrones is big. Game of Thrones was this phenomenon getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but now the conversations were getting bigger and bigger and bigger around it. And this is at the end of this episode, and going into the next couple of days after, this was the first time I remember really hearing. Now, again, season two, I think you can say, people were saying it was a little slower, not like season one. But this one, season three, episode one, the first time I really remember people going, just get to the point. Did this advance the plot? I get it. We're setting the pieces for season three, but I want some action. I think we're all, as the conversation got bigger, we're all craving the big reveals. We were craving episode nines. We wanted to know. We just didn't have the patience. But this season wants you to be a little bit patient as it moves you forward here. So I think the big theme for this episode, all the lessons are tied to this idea of what do you want? It's actually said a few times in this episode. A lot of it at Tyrion. What do you want? What do you actually want? And does it go beyond what you need or what you think you need? Is that really what you need? Is it really what you want? Now, I'll say this. Almost every episode and every scene of any show or movie ever written, produced, created, has this going on. This isn't some giant insight here. I'm not changing the way in which you look at shows or movies. But in this particular episode, it's very much in focus. And season two, episode one begins with, what kind of ruler are you? And who wants to rule this land? The clash of the army, you know, the armies of five kings are clashing, and we're going to meet those potential kings all through season two. And that's what the first episode of season two is about. Well, this one is a little different. All men must die, and they died. In many cases, they died. A lot of deaths at the end of season two, right? Now we must find out, can you serve? I think maybe it's even more the question than do you want to serve? We got examples of leadership all through this show, this particular episode. And those leaders have different versions on, you know, how to lead. Not only that, but like serving is part of leadership. You're kind of working for the others. And how do you do that? And how do you approach it? And how do you maintain that control that comes up? So a lot of it is, again, what do you want? Do you want to survive? Do you want power? Do you want respect, control? Do you want your place, your legacy? Big one, do you want to be a hero? It's all on the table, but I think this episode wants you to ask, what is behind that? Many of these characters, I think, are learning what they actually want. They're being forced to face the question about what do you want? What do you really want? What do you want? What do you need? Those kind of big things. That's what's going on here. I think there's some big John stuff, important Danny stuff, but giant, giant, no pun intended, Jon Snow stuff. Before we get to that, though, this cold opening sets the tone. We begin with the Night's Watch. Great sequence. Fun sequence. Tragic. You know, I love Samwell Tarly. I'm always rooting for him. It was a little frustrating. I mean that in a good way, when you're totally lost in the story of just watching him kind of have to explain to his mentor, the man he really loves and respects, Jor Mormont, the Lord Commander. Nah, I didn't get the Ravens. I didn't send him. So the Night's Watch sets the tone. What do they want? Well, they want to survive. They want to get back to the wall. They want to stay alive. It is survival. But what do they really want to do? What do they need to do? They need to warn everybody. Everybody is at stake here. Everyone is at risk. It is one of my favorite scenes, but also it is also one of my favorite lines. We need to get back to the wall. It's a long march. You know what's out there, but we have to make it. We have to warn them, or before winter's done, everyone you've ever known will be dead. Smash to that opening credits. Oh, that's a great moment. Jor Mormont. I love Jor Mormont. We got some sad Jor Mormont moments coming up. I know that, but here he is. I think that cold opening really sets the tone for this season. What do you want? Everyone wants to win the throne. Is that what it is? What do they really want? What are they really after? And we start diving in with big stuff with Jon Snow. Jon Snow at the end of season two, the great stuff with Ygritte says, now you get to meet, you know, you're going to meet the king behind the wall. And I got to tell you, it's similar. I always crossing those streams, taking that sip of Star Wars cantina water. It's somewhat similar to Luke. It's a hero's journey. John and Danny are both on their own kind of journeys. John might seem to be on a little bit more of the stereotypical hero's journey. And no hero on that journey wants to be a hero in the end. I think in the end. But they may begin that way. They may want to plug into the bigger story. Luke staring off into the twin suns. That's a lot about him wanting to leave his world, wanting adventure, wanting to be these things, and then wanting to be like his father, a great warrior. What's one of the first things that happens to him as his journey goes on, after he gets some great early victories? He goes to Yoda to continue his training, to be a great warrior. And he has a certain vision of who Yoda might be, who this Yoda warrior might be. And as we know, if you're a Star Wars fan of even a casual nature, Luke learns that wars aren't make you great. You know, you don't want to be a warrior. You're not here trying to be a hero. You're trying to serve, help, protect, knowledge, defense. Jedi doesn't crave adventure. It's a serious mind. It's a different thing. He's faced with it. He's faced with that truth. Jon Snow wants to be a hero. Corrin Halfhan in season two hatches this plan, says it pretty plain and true, basically, kill me, infiltrate Mance's army, and get back to us at the wall and tell us how to defeat them, because that's the foe. Save the realm. Be the hero. You've taken these vows. You are the watcher on the wall. John, you must do that. And John wants to go to the wall back in season one. He wants to find his place. He's the bastard on the outside of the Stark family. He wants to go be something else. He's dreaming of this. And so now he gets here. Ygritte takes him into the heart of it all, the heart of Mance's army, his large army that is so big that John at the end of season two sees it and gasps. He can't believe the just enormity of this army, the enormous scale of what Mance has done. He must be a spectacular king. He is the king beyond the wall, a ranger of the Night's Watch turned traitor who has united these armies, united these clans to destroy us all, right? That's what John is here for. He wants to be a hero. He wants to infiltrate the wildlings, kill Mance. So he meets Mance Rayder, but first we have the great moment. Tormund Giantsbane. Oh boy, we get some wonderful characters introduced in this episode. So many of them. Christopher Hivju is here as Tormund Giantsbane, that chicken eater. What a scene. What a great opening scene. Love it. And of course, Kieran Hines, the great Kieran Hines as Mance Rayder. This is actually the first scene he shot for his show, which is kind of rare that your first scene that you shoot is actually your first scene on the show. But great sequence. It is one of my favorites. I think Kieran Hines is so great as Mance Rayder that he's on the show so little. He's not on a lot when you really put it all together. Every line, every moment is just impactful. And this is, like I said, huge John stuff. I don't want it overlooked. I can't overstate it enough. John begins this conversation. He's nervous. He's scared. He's in the midst of enemies. He's trying to fake it enough to infiltrate. Tall task. Does what he feels he should do. Bow before the king beyond the wall, this great and glorious king. It's not the one he actually bows in front of. Mance says it pretty clear. We don't we don't bow. We don't bow to no one here. Which doesn't mean they don't serve. I think quite the opposite, but it's a different take up here. So right away, it's different for John. Right away, it's a little bit of a curveball. Not to just break down every line, but why I just love this scene so much. It's so key to John. When Mance asks him plain, you know, they get the, you know, he killed Corrin Halfhan, some great lines we'll mention later with Tormund Giantsbane and Jon Snow and little skeletons and all those kind of wonderful things. And I love Mance, you know, he's my enemy, and I'm glad he's dead, and all that kind of stuff. The traitor, you got the traitor line right away. John's like, if I'm a traitor, you're a traitor. Ooh, burn. The tension is palpable, right? Mance asks John, why are you here? John struggles. John gives him the answer. I want freedom. BS, says Mance Rayder. Sees right through it. Mance, I think, sees, and D.B. Weiss does explain it quite well in the post-credits kind of behind-the-scenes stuff, that Mance sees maybe a little of himself in John. And over time, John's going to see a lot of himself in Mance. They have a common goal in the end, the real war, right? We don't know that yet for Mance, and John doesn't know that yet for Mance. He sees still the king beyond the wall uniting the clans to destroy the Night's Watch and destroy the realm. That's still where John is at this point. That's why he's here. And Mance sees that. He says, no, I don't think so. I think what you want most of all is to be a hero. Jon Snow ends up being a big hero in the show, without a doubt. He's already a hero. Again, Luke Skywalker takes out the Death Star. Before he goes and learns about the journey he's actually on, Jon Snow's already done wonderful things. He already has some good connections. We already like Jon. He might be a Boy Scout, a little boring to some. I've heard that complaint too. But Jon wants to be a hero, and we kind of view him as a hero. But the lesson here is that you want to be a hero, but that's not really what you want, Jon. It's not really what you're here for. I think John's going to grow into that. But Mance forces him to think about that. It's a new choice he must make. John knows he cannot lie. He cannot lie to Mance Rayder. And John does want to be a hero. That's why he's here. But in this moment, whether or not John actually believes it in this moment, or again, as I think he grows into it over time, he's still got some fighting to do. He's still got some warring with the wildlings to do. He's still got some big things coming. But John is really on this, I'm not a warrior. I'm here to help people. And this is the moment where I think he starts to get it, or at least he's forced to. Again, he can't lie to Mance Rayder. Mance will see through it. He already has. You want to be a hero. John answers with his truth. He tells the story of what happened at Craster's Keep. We love Jorah Mormont, but he kind of throws him under the bus here a bit. But it's the truth. It's what John was feeling. He can still look up to Jorah Mormont and know that Mormont has to make tough choices and has to do it mostly for the good of the realm and with the good of the realm in mind. But John speaks his absolute truth here in this moment. He absolutely speaks it. I saw one of them. You're telling me you saw one of them. Yeah, I saw one of them. And that alone makes you want to join? No, no, no. What I experienced after, when I told Jorah Mormont, my Lord Commander, the one who wants me to be a leader, the one who I think wants me to be a hero, the one who's doing his best to defend the realm, he already knew. Back in that episode in season 2, we talked about these choices and these compromises. A lot about season 2 is about those compromises you might make for your goal or your pursuit. And Stannis is making these compromises all along the way. And I'm a Stannis fan. That breaks my heart. John speaks the truth. He's not lying to Mance. He wants to fight for the side that fights for the living. That was guiding John perhaps before he knew it. But going forward, everything he does goes towards that goal. That's what he really wants. Does he want to be a hero and stand in front of the horses of the army of Ramsay Bolton and pull his sword? No, he doesn't want to do that. He's doing all of it to defend those that can't be defended, to defend his home, his legacy, his family, to defend the realm, to stand before those armies. And I think John made some mistakes to get in that point in season 6, but we're a few years away from that. John's death, as we've talked about and we'll talk about again, John's actual death comes because he made a decision to fight for the side that fights for the living, and often that side isn't the one he's been fighting with or isn't the one that he was trained or raised to fight with. Not just shades of gray that we do love in this world, but he really in this moment starts to see it. Ygritte has made him already think about it. Why are you fighting us, she says to him in season 2. When he proudly proclaims, I am of the old blood as well. The blood of the first men runs through me. I'm Ned Stark's son. Then why are you fighting us? We're just on this side of the wall. And as John's learning, and probably about to learn, they're not on that side of the wall gathering their armies to destroy the wall and the Night's Watch and take the realm and destroy Winterfell. They're not here to do that. They just want to get below that wall. Now, we as fans know that. We, season 8 is behind us. We know everything about it. We know John starts to see them as free folk. He's already there. I think in this moment, he might still say wildlings, but that choice is, it's pretty important. It's pretty powerful. And I think it all ties to this moment. It is absolute to me. I'd say if I was ranking one of my top 10 favorite episodes in the show, because of what it means to John. The why of Jon Snow, I talked about that before, but in rewatching it this time, it became even more clear. This is a little bit of Luke and Yoda and Dagobah in Empire Strikes Back. John has shown up to expecting to see this great and glorious warrior king that has done the impossible, gathered these clans, gathered these armies, and is going to take over the world. And said what he's found is a man who says, don't kneel before me. We do not kneel. We do not bow. I'm here to serve you more than anything else because I just want to get below. I want to save all these people. That's what John is about to learn. And I'm maybe even skipping ahead in a couple episodes, some of the stuff that John's about to learn. But it all goes to this moment. John started to question things with Ygritte. And hey, I guess you could write that off. Hey, you know, pretty redhead, and I want to make some choices. But Ygritte's way more than that. Ygritte's way more than that. She's already got him thinking. And now his expectations, boom, have just been exploded out of the screen. Like wildfire hitting it. He does want to be a hero. He wants to go get the glory. He wants to, he has good in his heart. John is always purely driven. But going forward, he absolutely realizes a hero does not want to be a hero. And I think he truly grows into that statement of, I want to fight for the side that fights for the living. Love this scene. Absolutely one of my favorites. Absolutely one of my favorites. Like I said, there's a theme of serving in here as well with Mance Rayder. Speaking true, on even though he doesn't exactly say this stuff, it's pretty important. It's not just some defiant concept of we don't kneel, just like Mance not kneeling before Stannis. It's choice, it's freedom, it's true choice, it's true freedom. But he has become a leader. He is the king beyond the wall, unlike perhaps any kings in the past that we've heard about or that John's heard about. He's there because he's there serving everyone else. He's united them for their goal, not his survival. Ygritte in this scene, she has a great little moment, a great conversation leading into the tent. But in the tent, Rose Leslie gives a look, right? You could write it off as a little longing, you know, Kit Harington, her real life husband eventually, right? Yeah, he's got those pretty locks. He's got that pouty face. You know, she likes him. You could write that off as just that. But to me, it's also about what Ygritte wants. It sets it up for season three with Ygritte. Just by her bringing him here, just by her vouching for him. But now in that moment, looking at him, Mance sees it. Ah, the girl likes you. So what does Ygritte want? Well, you know, she might want John. That's fair. But what she really wants, what she really needs, is to believe that his turn is true. And that's going to be the crux of every one of their scenes going forward. She loves him. And the love is real. But she wants his transition to be real. She doesn't need him, doesn't want him to be a crow anymore. She wants him to be her, with her, one of her, a free folk, and for it to be real. Big stuff coming with them, so just off that look. Moving on to some of the other characters. I almost could just do the entire episode on that one scene with Mance and Jon Snow. I love it so much. We got Tyrion and Cersei. We're jumping around a little bit here. Tyrion, he wants to stay alive. You know, he's not in a great spot here. I love some of the stuff early on. I love, you know, we start with Bronn in the brothel. We know what Bronn wants in that scene, but Podrick comes to take him back. Tyrion wants to stay alive, right? He wants to stay alive because people are coming after him. He knows it's part of the, I don't know if I call it a mystery, but a little bit of a, you know, attempted murder mystery with him at the Battle of Blackwater Bay and who gave the order to have him killed, all that kind of stuff. So he wants to stay alive. That's what he needs Bronn for in that moment. Cersei shows up. Great stuff. Great sequence. Also, I love the little reference we'll talk about later about his nose, and that's clearly a book difference. Cersei wants to keep her power, keep her position, and also keep her secret. Very concerned about that, but there's bigger things going with Cersei here, but a great scene to start it off. And he's going to go meet his father. So what does Tyrion want? Well, let's jump to that scene. We go to Tyrion, and we're going a little bit later in the show, but I think this theme, this discussion of this theme and lesson, it begs us to kind of jump to that there. He goes to meet his father, Tywin Lannister, who did not show up to check on him while Tyrion convalesced and recovered from his injury. Tywin wants to end this war. He wants to cement his legacy. That much is clear. And he's writing a letter that matches that want. We'll talk about that letter writing in a bit. He asked Tyrion, plain and simply, and this is one of those moments where sometimes just what each and every episode is about. Just at one point, something always jumps out at you. Tyrion is asked by Tywin, now tell me what you want. Tyrion wants recognition, right? He helped plan the defense of Blackwater Bay. He wants his true place in the city. He wants his rightful place in his family. He wants Casterly Rock. He really thinks he deserves that, and I think we all could agree he probably does. Cersei might have some claims to that and her own frustrations with the patriarchal society there, that she couldn't get it there. Jaime, we know, is not here, and even if he was, he's part of the Kingsguard, unavailable to take it, maybe. So Tyrion, on just a very logistical spot, wants it, but what does he really want? He wants his father to recognize him. He wants his father to love him, maybe? Maybe. I think he might settle for his respect. Might be enough. I think Tyrion might be okay with just the respect. Let's start with the respect, Dad. But he wants his love from his father. I believe in season three, I think Tyrion could still accept him as his father and not see, can see past some of the monstrous sides of him. It's hard. I think it's a flicker. He wants it. That's all he wants. It isn't just that Tyrion wants that little hand of the king insignia and the emblem. He doesn't want that. He wants to know, Dad, why weren't you there? And it is a heartbreaking scene. It's so good, but it's a heartbreaking scene. Tywin Lannister, Charles Dance, just leans into everything he thought he knew and everything that's probably at one point true about Tyrion. Whoring around, drinking all around, all those kind of stereotypes at Tyrion. That, again, true, and Tyrion acknowledges that, but he's not that anymore. He's trying not to be that person anymore. And he's changing, and his season two story, his arc has changed him, and he wants something more, and he wants perhaps to protect the dynasty, the family name, the legacy, just as much as his father does, but he just wants him to recognize that. That sets the tone not only going forward for this season, but I think it it goes all the way into season four and to the final act that Tyrion takes against his father. I am a Tywin Lannister fan. I am. We got to see a lot of good Tywin stuff. Not that Tywin is good, but we saw some good Tywin stuff. We got a bit of his heart in season two. And here we are, right back. Cold, just harsh Tywin Lannister. He does not bend nor break. He wants to protect his legacy. He needs to end this war. He's got seven kingdoms to protect, and three are in open rebellion. These are the things he wants. He truly wants. And it will cost him, because he can't see the whole picture. Davos, we got some Davos stuff. Oh, the blistered Davos on the side of the rocks. And also one of my favorite, Liam Cunningham, so great, of course. But I've always loved his read on, you know, when they ask him, who are you? And he's like, I was in the battle. Real battle. I was in the battle. So Davos wants to get back to Stannis. He wants to see Stannis on the throne. He wants to kill Melisandre. But he's haunted by the death of his son. And I think he's wanted to be a father figure, and that drives him now. But he also really wants to see Stannis reclaim who he is and stay true to what he was. Davos is one of those pure characters in a way. His moral compass is on pretty straight, whether or not he does some shady things on the side. And one of the shady things, he's married. We don't know where his wife is. He sends a letter. I'm out. I'm getting the paper and some cigarettes. I'll be back in 8 years. But hey, that's Davos's life. But Davos stays true to himself right here in the beginning. And this factors in, again, to what he wants out of Stannis, someone he looks up to. He says to Stannis, you're an honorable man, a just man. And I've always said, as much as I love Stannis, but I'm fascinated with Stannis' fall, and that's the lessons of the character, I'm equally as fascinated with Davos, who, while everyone watching the show, everyone reading the stories, everyone watching is booing Stannis Baratheon, except for me and Eric Monroe and a couple of folks. But Davos is there too, holding true, holding his line of saying, you're an honorable man, a just man to Stannis. Well, everyone's booing. But part of that is Davos stays true to himself. And when faced with this tough question, when he's rescued, which king did you serve? Davos takes a moment. He knows the severity of the situation. If he answers this wrong, he's left on this rock to die. At best, they might just kill him right then and there. But he stays true. The one true king, Stannis Baratheon. And him being true to himself saves him in this scene, saves him in this moment, and drives him forward with Stannis. So, yeah, he wants to kill Melisandre, and he has those reasons. But he wants to make sure Stannis' honor is restored. And then I think himself in that scene with Salladhor Saan, great scene, great lines. Davos also feels that hole in the show. Only one son. He's lost him. Matthos is gone. And now he wants to feel like he has that kind of place. He let his son down, and he wants to fill that a gaping hole in his soul. And that will drive him going forward. We go to Robb Stark. I think Robb going into Harrenhal. We get to meet Qyburn. Qyburn alert. Anton Lesser showing up as Qyburn. Robb wants to keep the respect of his armies, but it's devolving around him. He's losing control. He senses it. And he wants to save face. Leadership is again about serving. That's part of the lessons, I think, this episode. Leadership is about serving, and that's getting harder for him. He can't serve those around him because he's got his mother making things a little hard for him. I don't fault Catelyn Stark as much as I used to anymore. I've grown to appreciate every decision Catelyn Stark makes. It's a harsh reality of a situation. That's my mother who wants to save our family. That's what she wants. But I want to avenge my father. I want to free the North. I don't necessarily want the Iron Throne, but I want to keep the throne or the crown I have now. But it's getting harder and harder and harder, and it's going to spiral out of control. And you just see it. The great shot. Richard Karstark and Roose Bolton just kind of looking as they walk into Harrenhal, and it ain't good. And everyone looking down on Catelyn. It's all starting to fail around Robb, and he knows it. He wants to recover. He wants to get the respect of his armies, of his men, of his women, of the people of his land that he now has. So it's going to be a tough journey for him. Bittersweet. Not even bittersweet, just bitter. Sansa's we're setting the Sansa arc here. She wants to go home. Baelish needs her as a piece to the puzzle and wants her. Talk about wheat needs and wants. Sansa wants the dream. That's the game she's playing with Shay, watching the ship sailing out of the bay. Great little scene. She wants to escape. She has that great line as Shay doesn't play the game. Shay just, oh no, that boat's going to Volantis. Oh yeah, what's the story? Well, because when I left Volantis, I got on a ship that looked like that. Well, Sansa's not happy with that, not just Shay being a bad game player with her, but Shay kind of bringing the reality, and Sansa doesn't want that because she says the truth is always either terrible, which she's experienced a lot of, or it's boring. She can't have the story be terrible anymore. She wants to go home. She feels that's her way out, and Baelish is there to offer it. Sets the tone, too. We talk about things that have foreshadowing and more meaning. We'll do that a little bit later, but Baelish kind of, I think, setting stuff all the way into season 4 with how he's going to get Sansa out. We also have got some great stuff here. Moving along here, I could go into each one probably a little bit long, but, I spend a lot of time with Mance in that tent there. We've got Daenerys Targaryen. We got a big scene with her, but then we end the show with her here. So let's go to Marjorie Tyrell. She's playing a wonderful game. We get to really spend time with her. She's now in Flea Bottom, stepping through the muck and mire to go win over the orphans of the city, win over the small folk, and to do it in a smart way. I believe, much like Jon a little bit, it's a truth for Marjorie. I don't think she's faking some of the care for the kids, but it's tactical. She wants Joffrey in her corner, if not to control Joffrey, but her weapons are different than anything Joffrey is used to. Cersei is on the other side of that, right? Cersei wants to keep her power. We already know by season 2, she's starting to lose control of Joffrey. That's a lot of the stuff that her and Tyrion were talking about in season 2. And now at least she has her place as the Queen's Regent, but now Marjorie is here because following the Battle of Blackwater Bay, Sansa, who at the time was much easier to control for Cersei, she's been replaced. Marjorie is in. I don't know if Cersei, did she, at the time, maybe that probably seemed good, but now it's starting to be a problem for her. She's losing control. Cersei wants to keep that control, right? Here comes Marjorie. What I love here, too, is Joffrey, what does Joffrey want? In this episode, is asking that too. Joffrey, as we know, wants to be considered the king. He wants the glory. It's all he knows. And here he is down at Flea Bottom. Great little Jack Gleason's got some great, when they stop that procession and Jack Gleason freezes up as Joffrey. He's gun-shy from the riot because the season two riot where High Septon was ripped apart and they were attacked, and that came out of Joffrey not knowing how to handle the people, not knowing how to. He wasn't secure in his own power. A cow pie in the head nearly destroyed him, nearly destroyed his entire procession, his family, everything. Here's Margaery roaming around the very same city that nearly ripped Joffrey apart and did rip some of his entourage apart. Margaery's just walking around freely, and I love Joffrey watching it and Joffrey seeing it, because Joffrey wants power, yes, but in a way he wants love. I'm not going to break it down to the point of like he never got the true love from his father, and that's probably true. I don't want to create too much sympathy for Joffrey, but he started out at some point as just a little kid before he started ripping legs off of bugs, I guess. I am fascinated by that little look of seeing Margaery, because now Margaery is saying, look, I want to control Joffrey. I want to be the queen. But how do I do it? How can I show him the other way? She's so wily. She's so smart. You want power, Joffrey? I can get you that power. You want to be considered the king? I can get you that consideration from all the small folk by not lording over them, by not, sitting up there in your ivory tower, almost literally, but by being down with them. Think of the stuff later on. There's some stuff, great stuff later on in the Sept, right? We'll jump ahead, but in the season, but where Margaery just goes, let's go out and let's go wave to the people. Joffrey's happy. It's one of the few moments of pure happiness on Joffrey's face. That moment is earned because of what goes on here. Joffrey's watching it. I want to be loved. I don't want to just be king. I want to be loved. Margaery's offering him away. Now, does Joffrey take it? Does Joffrey still have a bunch of problems? Oh, yeah. Again, I'm not trying to create a lot of sympathy for Joffrey, but I love what's going on here. It is truly a game. It's truly a power play. Cersei on one side. To be careful down there. They'll gut your heart out. Trust me, we were down there a while ago, and man, they tried to kill all of us, which we know is a fact. And Joffrey, my mom has a penchant for drama. Our lives weren't in risk. Which, by the way, I think that dinner scene with Cersei and Joffrey is one of the best duels in Game of Thrones. When Cersei throws back to him, oh, yes, well, you know, we all don't have, you get too much of your father in you. We don't have a king's courage, she says to Joffrey, who knows that he pretty much probably peed and crapped his pants down there and had to be saved. I love the barbs. I love the duel. And Cersei's the one, the undercutting of Margaery's dress and all that. It's a great scene. It is truly a fight. It is a duel between Cersei, Joffrey, Cersei, Margaery. Love it there, but I love it. And Cersei wants to keep that power, and she's watching Margaery sink her claws into Joffrey, and that's something that's always going on with her. Love it. Love the sequence. Love what's going on. Again, Margaery, just so smart. So smart. Shame she lost in the end, though. She went out, as best she could. We'll get there in season six. Daenerys Targaryen, we get two good scenes with her. We get to see her on the boat, on the ship, crossing the poison water with a barfing Dothraki. And it's pretty clear she wants to take the Iron Throne. But to do so, she needs an army. That's what she really wants right now, at least when we first meet her. She wants the army. Jorah wants her to have an army, wants her to have the Unsullied as a slave army. Because he knows the truth. She needs to prove herself as strong. Otherwise, the Dothraki won't follow her. And otherwise, quite frankly, the world won't follow her unless she can be strong. Dany, all through season two, of course, learned some painful but powerful lessons of not being in a position where she has to accept the help of others. She wants to control her own destiny as best she can. And her destiny, she feels at this point, I think, is taking the Iron Throne. But I think that's going to start changing. And I think it does start to change here. At Astapor with Krasnys. And, of course, Missandei's here. Natalie Emanuel's on the cast now. Another great debut. A lot of debuts in season three, episode one here. I think Dany is faced with the morality of the choice in front of her. Struggle and Barristan and Jorah will have that debate a little bit later on in the season. But I think in this moment, as she's watching this play out here, she's watching Krasny's cut off a nipple and insult her, and she plays the game so well of not pretending to not speak the language, and seeing the true value of Miss Andane, seeing how smart and careful and cautious and just particular with her words that Miss Andane is. Dany no longer just wants an army. I think in this moment, similar to what Jon Snow is being faced with, I think Dany really sees the future here, what she can be. She doesn't just want to take the Iron Throne. She doesn't just want an army. She needs it. But now she wants to free this army. And now she wants to free many in Slaver's Bay. I think it all starts to crystallize for her here. And she knows. She knows what she wants to do. A lot more in Dany's journey, I know. I don't think I even have time to get into it here. But I love this. I think... The moment's going to happen a little bit later in the season, the Dracarys moment, which is a great moment. I think that all forms right here and there. And I love Jorah, but he's a little step behind, right? Everyone's kind of a step behind Dany. She knows the plan. I do want this army. I do want the Unsullied. But now seeing what's done to them, hearing what has been done to them and how those are treated here in Astapor, in the Slaver's Bay, I know what I need to do. What I really want to do is free them all. And I really want people to follow me, but on their own accord and by their own free will. I think it's a key moment for Dany in this moment, in a great moment. We get the reveal of Ser Barristan Selmy, who wants to serve Dany. Yeah, he wants to serve, but he wants forgiveness and wants to feel worthy of his acclaim and make up for what he felt and feels is wrong. And maybe a little self-loathing, but Barristan Selmy. And I know Arts and White Bread, White Beard. I'm now hungry. I just said White Bread because I'd love a good White Bread sandwich. No. Arts and White Beard is the book version, right? Gosh, I'm even questioning if I'm saying that right. It's been a while. That's the book version. We get to spend a little bit more time with him in the books before he's revealed to be Barristan. And I know there were some critiques of this even back here. Again, the big critiques were already starting. But again, we're gonna get a little bit of that with Theon very soon. Theon and Reek. Again, I ask you. How could you possibly have hidden Ian McElhenney, Ser Barristan Selmy, on a show for half a season or even a full episode? I guess you could just accept that we know who the character is, but the TV show, the characters in the TV show don't know that it's Ser Barristan Selmy. But it's a hard sell, and it's a hard sell for Jorah. I actually love the book version. I love the book story, but I love that Jorah just in this moment is like, oh no, it's... Yeah, that's Ser Barristan Selmy. He's a great fighter. He also, helped take your father out and family and serve Robert Baratheon, the man trying to kill you. But it's okay. It's good. It's good. We're fine. I love it. So I love it. I love it. We get to deal with it. It is what it is. It's Ser Barristan Selmy. Great intro. Love the scene. I love the girl from the warlocks trying to kill Dany. A freaky, creepy moment. Bugs are always creepy, right? So I think it's great. Great way to end episode one. And we got everyone's wants and their true wants and what they need to understand about what their own desires are and their own goals. We had a lot more characters to be unveiled in season three, episode two, but we're setting big pieces here. So I love it. I love it there. Things have a little bit more meaning to them now that the show's all done. Perhaps some foreshadowing that we might have missed the very first time you're watching these episodes. Mance, I love Mance Rayder saying, we need to find you a new cloak. And then later on, when he meets Jon again, he says, you're wearing black again. I love that little thing there. We should, again, I want to know, Tyrion wants his father's respect, maybe even his love. And again, taking that all the way up to season four, knowing where that goes. I think there's some more meaning and foreshadowing there too. This is admittedly grim, but Meryn Trant being insulted by Bronn, and Bronn saying you're better at beating little girls than fighting men, which is a reference, direct reference to Sansa. But a little bit later on, what we learn from Meryn Trant, I wouldn't say he's a good dude. So a little more meaning there. Roose Bolton saying my best hunter is after him, talking about Jaime Lannister and just kind of knowing that that's Locke and what's coming there. I like that. Enter Anton Lesser, like I said, is Qyburn. It's such a moment. If you don't know, and I at the time, again, book one and two are in my rearview mirror. I had yet to read book three. I wanted to wait till after season three. this Qyburn moment, he says his name. It's Anton Lesser. I wasn't too familiar with him, but he's got a great career, great resume. I remember thinking, okay, it's some guy they saved. And when he comes back, I'm like, oh, that guy's hanging out. That guy's helping Jamie now. That's interesting. Qyburn, an amazing character, simply because he's interesting, but I think he becomes an amazing, just really intriguing character because of Anton Lesser. Love what he's done. Big part of the show, and he's introduced right here. Of course, so this is just so simple, and it's easy. It was easy to overlook for me. We go to Tywin Lannister. There's a couple things. Yelling at Tyrion about bringing a whore into my bed. With what's going to happen with Shay and that bed. That means a lot more now. But Tywin writing letters. It's so simple. And you can pause and do a little bit of a read on what he's saying, what he's writing in those letters, of course. But for someone like me, and many viewers of this show at the time in 2013, not knowing what this red wedding's going to be, not knowing what's coming, I remember thinking, and I wasn't on a podcast at this time. We were doing Schmoes Know at this time, but we weren't really breaking down the show on a weekly basis. But I just remember, like, to my friends going, man, every time they cut to Tyrion, he's just writing letters. That's all he's doing this year. He's just writing letters. Not only a lesson learned for this show and this season, but a lesson learned for me when you're taking a deeper look and discussing these shows of genre and big fandoms. Look at everything. Look at the big picture. Don't make assumptions. Don't overlook things. Again, themes and lessons. What does Tywin want? He wants to end this war and cement his legacy, and he's literally doing that in every scene, writing to the phrase, to Roose, to everyone, to cement that legacy. I got great stuff with Roz and Shay. I love the little scene. Here's two sex workers trying to claw their way out of their situations, and they have a great little moment with Roz. It's not easy for girls like us. Love Shay being guarded, but you get to see her face. It's a great little shot scene. And Roz saying, watch out for her with him about Sansa and Baelish, unfortunately has more meaning now. I also just really love the moments with Davos and Melisandre. They're intertwined, and their stories, especially Melisandre's story, ends in front of Davos's eyes in season 8. So I love this moment when when she says to Davos, I'm not your enemy, and he yells back, you are my enemy. That never goes away, right? It never goes away, even to season 8. When she shows up in season 8, Davos has a look like, all right, I said I'd kill her. I'm going to go kill her. I'm going to go kill her. I'm going to go down and kill her. And he doesn't, and he sees her end. He sees what she does. They have such an intertwined relationship and what goes on with Shireen and Stannis and everything. So I love it's not necessarily foreshadowing to me. It just means a lot to me now for him to just proclaim, you are my enemy. Favorite lines and scenes and moments. There's a lot going on. I mentioned the Jorah Mormont quote. I just love, before winter's done, everyone you've ever known will be dead. I think it was so wonderfully delivered. The opening scene with John walking into the camp of the wildlings, the free folk there. Ian White is the giant. Of course, Ian White was Sir Gregor in season 2. They were going to recast him, so he gets the giant role and he plays several other roles too. So good stuff there. Mentioned the Tormund. I love Tormund Giants, man. Here we go. What an intro. He's going to be a key part of the show to the very end. And it also just means more him and John meeting, knowing where they end up, right? But I love the line, plenty of little men try to put their swords through my heart. And there's plenty of little skeletons in the ground. I love that. I mentioned the Cersei mentioning Tyrion's nose. I say you lost your nose, but it's not as gruesome as all that. Again, a change from the books. Yes, in the books, Tyrion is just horribly deformed from this injury. Nose gone. Just he's hard to look at, which was part of the point of that character in the books. There was just no way you're going to get Peter Dinklage to run around six more seasons. Yeah, 6 more seasons with his face half cut off. Makeup, prosthetics, it's just no way. So you give them the score, and I think this show deals with it in a fun way. I just love the line from Salador San, and you drank with me on 4 of my wedding days, and I don't ask for favors. Salador San, just a great character. I also love it in that tense scene with Tyrion and Tywin. I do love when Tywin's accusing him of drinking with was drinking with the bad guys and hanging with harlots, and Tyrion shoots back, occasionally I drank with the harlots. And he actually kind of smiles at himself, just kind of smiles at the good times, but also is at the line. You know, my dad's yelling at me, but I could still get him with them. I mentioned it with Cersei and Joffrey at the dinner. It's just one of the best duels in Game of Thrones. It really is. I love this. And Cersei saying, you're right, of course. You're your father's son. We all can't have a king's bravery. Just great stuff there. I mentioned Dany's smile. Watch it again. Watch that scene again. Dany smiling to herself kind of when she's in front of the Unsullied. And to me, she knows her plan. She knows it right there. Dracarys later on, that's no accident. She knew what she was going to do. She's so smart. She's so ahead of that game there at this point in her life and times and career there. Final favorite little moment. You know, I love Stannis Baratheon. No secret there. Davos being brought back and Stephen Delane. And this was specifically mentioned. You can go again, read Fire Cannot Kill Dragon by James Hibbard. Great little book behind the scenes. Official look at some of the stuff there. Liam Cunningham is kind of asked or brings up in the interviews. The book is a collection of a lot of interviews, new and old. About, you know, Stephen Delane, reputation for being a little, maybe a little grumpier, maybe less interested in talking about Game of Thrones. A bit dour, a little bit like Stannis. Liam Cunningham defends him, and he had obviously so many scenes with him, and defends him and says that's not necessarily true. And he's a great scene partner and he's a great actor. And makes wonderful choices. And Liam Cunningham actually cites this scene where Stephen Delane hears you know, Davos walk in, and he doesn't turn around. He doesn't make the choice to be big. And, oh, my gosh, Davos back. He just looks at him, takes back. He takes this great beat, this great moment, and just says, I heard you were dead. Davos says, not yet. Great stuff. But it's just the performance of Stephen Delane, just knowing every word, every movement that he makes is telling that story too. So much great acting in the show, without a doubt. And that's a little quiet moment. That's one of my favorites. Episode stars. We always like to highlight some of the stars of the episode. I think everyone's a star. Kieran Hines and Christopher Hivju, I want to highlight out just that great opening sequence. Clearly, I loved it. I just talk so much about it. It's such a just a wonderful introduction to those characters. I really enjoy them. I also want to shout out Dan Hildebrand as Krasnus. So Krasnus Mo Naklaus, you know, so many letters, so many consonants and vowels. Dan Hildebrand is so good in this role. You want to see him die, right? He's a great character actor. And do this little game. Grace and I were rewatching Deadwood. I love Deadwood, and she had never seen Deadwood. We're watching the first episode of Deadwood, and I almost like forgot. Almost forgot that he was in it. But Dan Hildebrand is in the first episode of Deadwood. He plays an Irish immigrant that is run afoul of Ian McShane. And if you go back, you could almost miss it. He plays Shaughnessy, and he also will play Tim Driscoll. It's quite frankly stunning. It's so interesting. And I actually paused. We just watched this a couple weeks ago. I actually paused the screen and I looked at Grace and I said, recognize that? And she, no. I said, think Dracarys. We both had just a great moment. He's just a great little character actor, man. And I think he's great as Krasnys. I think he just does exactly what is needed out of that character. And you want to see him burn. Final episode star is someone not on the show, but someone involved in the show. And that's David J. Peterson. And I had the pleasure of interviewing and meeting David J. Peterson over on the old Screen Junkies days, on the Watching Thrones days. He's the guy that created all the languages in the show. And that's what he does, is a linguist, right? You know, Tolkien was so good and created his own language to the point that he needed a story. The Hobbit and some Lords of the Rings, just to make my language work. David J. Peterson, fascinating character, interesting cat, and had a lot of just interesting things to say about creating all these languages, including a language for the White Walkers that really was never used on the show, a language for the children, all these kind of things, and a lot of scenes that were even cut. There was a lot of dialogue with the children in their own tongue, in their own language that didn't get into the show. But the High Valyrian does, and it's so key to the show, and it we've heard it before. Valar Morghulis, Valar Dohaeris, we've definitely heard it before. But by the time you get to Astapor, and you've got entire scenes, and yes, you got the subtitles, but you got the entire scene, and Dan Hildebrand and all these actors, Natalie Emanuel and Amelia Clark, speaking High Valyrian like it ain't no thing, and it's this real, just lived-in language. That's David J. Peterson, and definitely want to highlight him here and say he's an episode star. So there you go. That is our look. We are into season three, season three, episode one. I've been talking all day. Valar Dohaeris is in the books. We are moving on to the other characters that we didn't get to meet. The cast, the stories are so big and sprawling, we can't even fit them into one episode to launch the season. We got to make it two, which again was interesting. We'll talk about it next episode. But I think that's why you really started to hear these conversations of, oh, this season of Game of Thrones is so slow. Can we get to the action? And then later on in season seven, the producers go, hey, let's just get to the action. And everyone goes, gosh, the show moved too fast. Could we just take more time with the characters? To try to make fans happy. What a tough task indeed. All right, that is it for now. You can follow me at Catnapsock. Go follow the GPA, the Good People GPA, on Instagram and Twitter. Go to our website, thegpa.fun, and consider joining at a membership level. But also, you get to enjoy all the content on the YouTube channel, the Twitch channel, and right here, Casually Talk. Subscribe, tell a friend, and we are building towards House of the Dragon. Don't you worry. This will be your location for our discussions on House of the Dragon coming sometime in season one coming sometime in 2022. We just got a little tease. A little tease was released. No plot, no care, just a logo on fire, dragons burning. We like that. So this is going to be your spot. And also for those listening on the podcast, I can't thank you enough. Keep listening on the podcast. Keep downloading. That really helps us as well. That is it for right now. We'll see you next time. Valar Dohaeris, my friends. All men must serve.